the commission. Now, he lived in Judea. He went to Rome in order to be confirmed as the king of Judea. Then he came back and ruled. His presence ruled. And yet, to receive his kingdom in Judea, he had to leave Judea and go to Rome, where the seat of authority was that was commissioning him, and to receive that, you know, confirmed. And then he came back and actually set up house and physically ruled the nation of Judah for a little while until they got kicked out because of his abuses. But the point is, when Jesus said a nobleman went to a far country to receive a kingdom and to return, without knowing that bit of history, you might wonder, well, did he go to receive a kingdom that's far away and then he comes back and leaves the kingdom behind that he found, or what? But the concept probably is that of that recent historic event that happened while Jesus was still a youth, of Archelaus, that he received a kingdom there in Judah, but he had to go away to Rome to be confirmed by the emperor in that role, and then he comes back to rule it. So also, he seems to depict himself that way. He goes to heaven, to the seat of authority of the universe. He receives his kingdom, and eventually, he comes back personally to rule, which I believe he will in the new heaven and the new earth, when he comes back. We are now in that period of time he describes as the time when the 10 servants are administering his estate, where they are stewarding his goods and seeking to make gains for his kingdom and for his enterprise. Now, that being so, Jesus saying that he was going away to receive a kingdom dovetails rather perfectly with Daniel 7:13, because here's the Son of Man coming to the Ancient of Days, not coming from the Ancient of Days to earth, but coming into heaven. From earth, it is presumed. And by the way, remember when the disciples watched him ascend, let's say, a cloud received him out of their sight. It says in Acts chapter 1. They watched him go up, and then they couldn't see him any longer because he went in the clouds. Daniel, apparently, is on the other side of those clouds in heaven, watching him come up through the clouds, coming with the clouds to heaven, to the Ancient of Days. And what happens there? To him is given a dominion and glory and a kingdom, in verse 14. So he went into heaven to receive a kingdom. So I personally think, certainly I'm in a very small minority, I think, in this interpretation, but in comparing Scripture to Scripture, as long as I think the Scripture teaches it, I've never bothered how many other people agree. It seems like what happens at the end of the vision here is a parenthetical flashback to something that, as I say, happened earlier, coincides with an earlier part of the vision, but was not convenient to discuss at the time because of the flow of thought and the concentration on the little horn that arose and so forth. But whereas Daniel 2 focuses on the establishment of the kingdom of God at Christ's first coming, and then just passes over the whole church age with a vague statement, and it grew into a great mountain and filled the earth, this passage passes over the establishment of it and talks about what happened during that time while it was growing into a great kingdom, and the persecution of it at that time. And then before it closes down, it says, and I also saw, you know, the kingdom be established to the Son of Man, which he doesn't say where that falls chronologically, but because it's parenthetical, it could be anywhere. We happen to know historically when it was. And, of course, we can use Daniel chapter 2 to discover where that was. It was during the reign of the Fourth Empire. Well, I will not pretend that I've removed all occasion of confusion from these passages. There's still plenty of occasion to be confused about them. And there's much more to be said about the term Son of Man and so forth, but we don't have time to get into it. We probably won't do justice to chapter 8 as we need to do. But as I say, fortunately, chapter 8 doesn't require as much conjecture. For one thing, chapter 8 gives in the clearest possible terms the interpretation of its own vision, fortunately. In starting around verse 20, it gives the interpretation, 20 through 22. So, and the terms of the interpretation are so clear that no one can miss them. So we don't really have to have controversy over this thing. Let's read, however, in chapter 8. This is a vision that happens in the third year of Belshazzar. The one in chapter 7 happened 2 years earlier, in the first year of Belshazzar. Okay? And this vision, as it turns out, will focus on the second and third of those four kingdoms. Babylon is no longer in view here, probably because in the third year of Belshazzar, probably about the time that the kingdom fell to the Medes and Persians. This vision is going to focus on the Persian Empire and its successor, the Grecian Empire, and particularly on another little horn. And virtually all scholars agree the little horn in chapter 8 is not the same little horn as in chapter 7, because it's not in the same era. The little horn in Revelation 7 grew out of the fourth beast. The little horn in Daniel 8 grows out of the third beast, as it turns out, the Grecian Empire. And so we got two different persecutors of the saints at two different times. And this one is very easy to identify. Unlike the little horn of chapter 7, which is difficult and controversial, this little horn is easy to identify. Okay? In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after the one that appeared to me the first time. Now, in saying after the one that appeared the first time, it almost sounds redundant. But what he's saying, apparently, is this is sort of a follow-up on the previous one. This is going to be connected in subject matter to the previous one. Not identical, but it's sort of like a sequel to it. I saw in the vision, and it so happened while I was looking that I was in Shushan, also known as Susa. Later on, it was the capital of Persia, though Daniel was still in Babylon when he had this. In the vision, he was transported to the Persian capital. The citadel, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in the vision that I was by the river Ulai. Now, the river Ulai is actually just a canal by that name Susa, the capital of Persia, was, or later a significant city of Persia, was built on this canal. And so Daniel sees himself transported there. Then I lifted my, just like Ezekiel was in Babylon, saw himself transported to Jerusalem for some of his visions. Then I lifted up my eyes and saw, and there standing beside the river was a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last, or second. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no beast could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. And as I was considering, suddenly a male goat, a ram, by the way, is a male sheep, so this is a goat now, challenging the sheep. Suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. Now, anyone who wants to be literal is going to have trouble here because Alexander the Great is this goat, and everyone knows that. I mean, there's no way to miss it when the interpretation is given. That he's not touching the ground, he covers the whole earth. I think we are being forced to deal with the fact that in apocalyptic visions, earth and stuff like that is not literal. It has a limited range of its application. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. That notable horn actually is Alexander, as we shall see. Then he came to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen, standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. Therefore the male goat grew very great, but when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in place of it, four notable horns came up toward the four winds of heaven. And out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great towards the south, towards the east, and toward the glorious land. Now, the rest up for quite a while, up through verse 14, is going to be about this little horn. But just to make sure you don't get this confused with the previous little horn, let me read in the later verses the interpretation of those verses we've already looked at. If you look at verse 20, it says, "The ram which you saw, having two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia." Okay, no question about that. That's the Media-Persian Empire is the ram. By the way, the ram was the ensign of the Medo-Persian Empire, and it is said that in the ruins of Persepolis, one of the capitals of the Persian Empire, you can see emblems of a ram's head with one horn higher than the other. That it says in verse 3, the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. What it means is that Persia, which arose later than Media, became more considerable than Media. The larger horn came up later. Media, Persia are the two horns, Media and Persia. The second horn to come up was Persia, but it grew higher. It grew taller. It was a more considerable power in the empire, okay? So we have no question as to who the ram represents. It's Media, Persia. We're told that in verse 20. How about the he-goat? Well, in verse 21, "And the male goat is the kingdom of Greece." Okay, well, we know that the Grecian Empire conquered the Persian Empire, so this is really straightforward stuff. "The large horn that is between his eyes is the first king." That's Alexander the Great. Can't miss that. Alexander the Great is the first king of the Grecian Empire. There were other rulers of Greece before him, but it was not the Grecian Empire until Alexander conquered the world. So the first king of the Grecian Empire that conquered Media-Persia was Alexander. This is not hard to interpret, fortunately. And I don't think you'll find anyone who disagrees with this particular interpretation. It's a relief to find something like that in Daniel, where everyone seems to agree. As for the broken horn, verse 22, and the four that stood up in its place, the four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. Now, I've told you before, when Alexander died, the kingdom was divided between his four generals. None of them had quite the same power or extent of authority that he had. They divided it up among themselves. So this, well, I mean, what's remarkable about this is that Daniel said this back in the year 539 BC, and it was almost 200 years later Alexander rose up and did these things. The Persian Empire lasted for about 200 years, and yet Daniel, 200 years before Alexander's time, though he doesn't name Alexander, he describes his career and what happens after his death very accurately. Yes, David, did you have something?
What are the liberals, what's your textual?
What do they do with this? Well, they late date the whole book of Daniel. They would say, well, the book of Daniel, because it is so accurate here, it couldn't have been written before the event. It must have been written after all these things happened. The common liberal view of Daniel is that it was written sometime in the 2nd century B.C. That'd be like 100-something B.C. That's about 400 years too late for the actual time of writing. But the reason is because we'll find, even in this vision and later on in chapter 11, very, very specific information about the career of Antiochus Epiphanes. Well, Antiochus Epiphanes, he wasn't until 175 B.C., and so those who don't believe in predictive prophecy have to say, well, it must have been written after the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, or at least during his time. Yes? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a number of things in Daniel that have been historically vindicated and verified. Yeah. There's many reasons. I mean, very, very many reasons to accept the traditional date of Daniel. Not the least of which is that Josephus says that when Alexander the Great came toward Jerusalem to destroy it, the priest in the temple, the high priest in the Jewish temple, took the book of Daniel out and read portions of the book of Daniel to Alexander the Great that were about him. And Alexander did not conquer Jerusalem by force. Instead, he dismounted, he went and offered sacrifices to the Jewish God, and he gave Jews positions of prominence throughout his empire because he was so impressed with the book of Daniel. Now, some say, oh, you can't trust Josephus, but if you can't trust Josephus, what historian can you trust? I mean, why can't you trust him? Just because he's a Jew? The fact is, there's as much reason to believe Josephus' testimony in that as any other historian's on anything. And, of course, if that is a true story, and Josephus presents it as historically true, then the book of Daniel existed before Alexander the Great made his conquest. It had to, or else the priest couldn't have read it to Alexander. And that's a long time. That's 100 years before Antiochus or so. So, I mean, there's the liberals are on a very, very slippery and thin ice, you know, in trying to postulate a late date for Daniel. And they have no reason whatsoever to defend such a late date, except for the presupposition that no one could have known these things before they happened. That's really their whole that's their whole premise. No one could know the future before it happened. Therefore, since it so clearly and indisputably describes the career of Alexander and of some of his successors, it must have been written after that time. Now, anyone who's not saddled with such an unreasonable bias against predictive prophecy doesn't have to think that way. We can just be impressed. Wow, you know, this is really amazing how clear and how accurate this was, written 200 years before its fulfillment here. Now, okay, so we have, up to this point, we've identified the ram, we've identified the goat, and the horn, the notable horn on the goat, as well as the four horns that came up after it was broken. This represents Persia, conquered by Greece, Alexander being the first king, after his death was replaced by four generals who divided his kingdom. They didn't have quite his power, but they took his kingdom over. So all of that is straightforward. No interpretive problems there. Now, we look at verse 9. And out of one of them, that is, out of one of the four horns, another horn grows up. Off the horn, another little horn grows out of it. Now, we know this can't be the little horn of the previous chapter, because the little horn of the previous chapter came out of the fourth beast, which is the Roman Empire. Whereas this little horn grows out of one of the four generals that took over Alexander's reign before the Roman Empire ever came along. So we've got a different little horn, but has many things similar in his career. And God is simply revealing that the people of God would have more than one occasion to suffer at the hands of dictators or persecuting powers. So out of one of these four horns, and we know from history which one it was out of the Seleucid dynasty, which took over Syria, grew an exceedingly great, this little horn who grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, toward the glorious land. And it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. Now this is apocalyptic literature. It is not to be thought that Antiochus Epiphanes, whom all agree this is about, that he literally went up into heaven and threw down stars from the sky. Later on in Daniel chapter 12, verse 3, Daniel says, "Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever." So the righteous in Daniel are compared to the stars. And when it says that this little horn, it goes toward the glorious land, that'd be Israel, of course, and he grows up to the host of heaven and casts down some of the host, some of the stars, and tramples them. It is figurative language, no doubt, for the fact that Antiochus persecuted and killed a great number of godly Jews. The compromised Jews he left alone, but the Hasidim, the holy ones, he destroyed as much as he could. And so this casting of the host of heaven to the ground by this little horn is generally understood, and I think properly must be understood, as his persecution of the godly. Those who turn many to righteousness are like stars in Daniel 12:3, and here also, I suppose. Now, that raises questions as to the meaning of a similar statement in Revelation chapter 12 and verse 4, I think it is. Everyone knows that Revelation reintroduces a lot of the symbolism of Daniel. There's many, many things in Revelation that have their precedent in Daniel, and this is one of them. In Revelation 12 and verse 4, it's talking about the dragon, who is identified in verse 9 as the devil. But of the dragon, it says in Revelation 12:4, his tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. Okay? Now, that short statement, that a third of the stars of the heaven were thrown to the earth by the tail of the dragon, has been interpreted by many throughout history to mean that a third of the angels fell when Satan fell. Of course, this is predicated on the assumption that Satan's a fallen angel and that when he fell, he took with him a third of the angels. There are so many Christians who believe this, as if it's taught clearly in the Bible, that one hardly ever finds anyone who would question it. But if you ask, where do we get this notion that a third of the angels fell? There's only one verse in Scripture upon which it can be based, and it's Revelation 12:4. There is no other verse that makes any slight hint or suggestion that way at all. Now, of course, in order to interpret Revelation 12:4 in that way, we have to assume that the stars of heaven represent the angels of God. However, it seems quite clear that the imagery of casting stars to the ground here in Revelation 12:4, it actually comes from Daniel 8:10. It's like it's what Antiochus did. He cast some of the host of heaven to the ground and trampled them. The idea of a bad person or a bad entity throwing down stars to the ground, hurling them down, at least in Daniel 8:10, almost certainly refers to the persecution of the saints, destroying godly people physically by persecution and martyrdom. That's what Antiochus did, and there's a good chance that's what the dragon did in Revelation 12:4. There's a good chance it means the same thing there as it means in Daniel. Now, of course, it might mean something different in Revelation, but I will say that if we gave it the same meaning in Revelation that we give it in Daniel, it makes perfectly good sense in Revelation as much as it does in Daniel. And therefore, I'm inclined to take the shortest distance between two points and say Revelation 12:4 is probably talking about the destruction of godly people through martyrdom, not the falling of angels. But if it is not, if Revelation is not talking about the casting down of a third of the angels, then no place in the Bible does. That's the only thing. That's the whole verse. That's the whole proof text for a fall of a third of the angels. There's nothing else in the whole Bible to even suggest anything close to it. There are, of course, passages that speak of angels that fell. In both Jude and 2 Peter, it mentions there are angels who fell, but we're never told that a third of them fell. We're not told when they fell or whatever, anything like that. But the idea that a third of the angels fell when Satan fell is taken entirely from Revelation 12:4. And it seems like that might be better understood another way in view of Daniel. Yes, Derek. I don't know if I've specified. I did mention Antiochus Epiphanes. The little horn is Antiochus Epiphanes. I'll have more to say about that. Well, we'll get into that. I haven't had a chance to really deal with that yet. Yes, it's like Antioch, like the city Antioch, A-N-T-I-O-C-H, and then with a U-S, Antiochus. Epiphanes is spelled E-P-I-P-H-A-N-E-S. Epiphanes means the illustrious one. It's the name he gave himself. History knows him as Antiochus IV. There were three Antiochuses before him. Historically, he is Antiochus IV. He labeled himself Antiochus Epiphanes, the illustrious one. He had opponents even in his own day, and they nicknamed him Antiochus Epimenes, which sounds very much like Epiphanes. But Epimenes means, in Greek, the madman. And so where he styled himself to be Antiochus the illustrious, his opponents called him Antiochus the madman. And Epiphanes and Epimenes are similar sounding in the Greek. So, anyway, that's the man we're talking about here. And I'll tell you more about him as we get to the relevant passages. But getting ahead of myself a little bit here. Okay, now, this little horn, he cast down some of the host and the stars to the ground and trampled them. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. I'll tell you in a moment some of the interpretations of that. And by him, the daily sacrifices were taken away. And the place of his sanctuary was cast down because of transgression. An army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices. And he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, "How long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of the desolation? The giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot." And he said to me, "For 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed." Okay, now, this little horn is said to exalt himself as high as the prince of the host. The prince of the host is generally understood to be a reference to God. However, since the word prince is used rather than king, some would say Jesus, because he's God's son. However, the word prince is used regularly in the scriptures to simply mean ruler. A king can be called a prince. In fact, the king of Tyre is sometimes called the prince of Tyre in the same passages in Ezekiel. Prince of Tyre, king of Tyre. We think of a prince specifically as the son of a king. But the word prince in scripture is almost generic of a ruler. It's anyone who rules. The princes of Judah are the rulers of Judah. They may not be related to the king, but those who rule are the princes thereof. When Jesus is said to be the prince of the kings of the earth in Revelation, it means the ruler of the kings of the earth. He's not under the kings of the earth. He's not the son of them. The prince of the kings of the earth literally means the ruler of the kings of the earth. So when it says this man exalts himself as high as the prince of the host, probably just means the ruler of the host. Now the host could be the Jewish armies, or it could be the heavenly armies, either way. In either case, God could easily be seen as the one who's the ruler of the hosts. There are some who have understood the prince of the host to refer to the high priest, who is the spiritual leader of the Jewish hosts. And the reason for that is because Antiochus Epiphanes is known to have displaced the high priest and put in a man of his own choosing who paid him for the job. But I think the more general view is that the prince of the host is a reference to God. And it says, by him, by the little horn, the daily sacrifices were taken away. Now, as you probably know, in the dispensational vision of the Great Tribulation at the end of time, at the end of this age, it is believed by many that there will be a rebuilt temple in Jerusalem and that there will be sacrifices beginning to be offered again. But in the midst of the tribulation, it is believed that those sacrifices will come to an end because the Antichrist will put an image of himself in the Holy of Holies, desecrating the temple. All godly Jews will then flee across the Jordan to Petra and hide out there for the duration of the tribulation, or from there make forays out doing evangelism or whatever. But the point is that the sacrificial system will come to an end in the middle of the tribulation because of the Antichrist and his image there. Now here, it says this little horn will take away the daily sacrifices, and it says the place of his sanctuary shall be cast down. And because of transgression, an army was given to oppose the daily sacrifices and to cast truth to the ground. He does all this and prospers. Now, the similarities in verses 11 and 12 to what dispensationalists believe the Antichrist will do have led many who are careless to think maybe this is a picture of the Antichrist in the last days. However, dispensationalists themselves, who are not careless, the ones who, you know, are careful to look at the whole context, have noted, no, this is about Antiochus Epiphanes. This is not about the Antichrist. But they would say, but by secondary fulfillment, it probably applies to the Antichrist. In other words, many dispensationalists would say, while this is a prophecy that was fulfilled 168 years before Christ by Antiochus Epiphanes, a tyrant who ruled over the Jews, it has a secondary fulfillment, and it sort of glimpses and foreshadows the reign of the Antichrist in the end times. Now, why do they say this? Because they believe the Antichrist will do this. Now, if indeed we knew for sure the Antichrist was going to do this kind of thing, that there was in fact going to be an Antichrist who would do these things, then it would be very tempting, I wouldn't say compelling, but at least tempting, to say, well, there is a secondary fulfillment of this in the last days. My problem is that I don't know of any passage in the Scripture elsewhere that says there's going to be a future Antichrist that would do such a thing as this. I know the Scriptures that are used, and we'll find them. We'll find them in Daniel chapter 9. We'll find them elsewhere in Revelation, and we've seen some of them in Thessalonians. But as far as I'm concerned, if you take all these passages in context, they don't teach that there's going to be a future Antichrist who will set up his image in a temple in Jerusalem and so forth. I mean, maybe that'll happen, but I don't see it taught in any of these passages. And therefore, without an independent set of scriptures to teach that the Antichrist will do such a thing, it's hard to just on a whim say, well, this is a foreshadowing of the Antichrist who will do these things, because how do we know he's going to do them? The Bible doesn't say so anywhere. But that is nonetheless how some have understood it, that this is Antiochus Epiphanes but foreshadowing the Antichrist himself. Now, a question is asked. I'll give you the history around this in a moment, but the question is asked here by apparently one holy one speaking to another. How long is this prophecy, this vision concerning the daily sacrifices, verse 13, and the transgression of the desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? How long is that for? And the answer is given for 2,300 days. Now, once again, I think that the historicist reformers understood this to be 2,300 years, a day for a year, in their interpretation. But it's really hard to figure out where you start and where you end it, especially if Antiochus Epiphanes is in view here. But if he is, if Antiochus Epiphanes is the beginning of this and the end of it is in 2,300 years from his time, then that time has not yet come. That time is not too far off from now, but it's not yet come. It's about 150 years off still, approximately. So some historians might still think this is talking about 2,300 years and the fulfillment is yet to be seen. Probably a better interpretation of this is that the word days, which is there in verse 13, 2,300 days, we need to see what it says in the, verse 14. In the Hebrew, it doesn't say days. It doesn't say 2,300 days. It says 2,300 evening mornings. And the translators of the King James and the New King James have rendered it as days. But in the Hebrew, it says 2,300 evening mornings. Now, since earlier in this talk, in the immediate context, it's been talking about the daily sacrifices, which, according to Exodus 29, were offered in the morning and in the evenings. It is probable that this doesn't say 2,300 days, but rather 2,300 evenings and mornings combined. That'd be half as many days. 2,300 sacrifices, sacrifice occasions, would pass while the temple was desolated. And since there was a sacrifice in the morning of every day and the evening of every day, that'd be only half as many days, because you get two such sacrifices per day. So if it's 2,300 evening, morning sacrifices, then that would be only, 1,095 days, right? 1,150 days, right. Now, there is a reasonable application of that. Let me give you some historical background here. We'll try to clean this up. Antiochus Epiphanes, I've been making reference to. I haven't really in this session told you much about him, but we have mentioned him before at various times. Let me give you a little history here. The Jews, when Alexander died, and his kingdom was eventually divided among four generals, one of those generals occupied and controlled the region south of Palestine, which is Egypt. And that was Ptolemy. Ptolemy was the general who did that, Ptolemy the First. He initially controlled Egypt and Palestine. So, upon this reapportioning of Alexander's empire, Palestine initially, for about 100 years, was under Egypt, under the actually Greek ruler of Egypt, Ptolemy. To the north of Israel was Syria, and another general occupied and controlled Syria. His name was Seleucus the First. There were two others, Cassander and Lysimachus, but we don't need to talk about them because they don't enter into the biblical prophecy at all. But Seleucus was the general who ruled the region north of Israel, Syria. Ptolemy was the general who took the region south of Israel, and including Israel, which was Egypt and Palestine. And there were wars between Ptolemy and Seleucus and their descendants. We will read about a detailed treatment of those wars in chapter 10 and 11. We'll wait until then to get into the detail of that. But one of the successors of Seleucus in Syria conquered Palestine and took it from the Ptolemies, from Egypt. So that now Israel came under Syrian control, under the Greek-Syrian rulers. There was a Seleucus the First, and there was an Antiochus the First, followed by a Seleucus the Second, followed by an Antiochus the Second. Then a Seleucus the Third, followed by an Antiochus the Third, and so forth. Well, eventually there was this Antiochus the Fourth, several generations after Alexander's time and after the original generals who reapportioned his land. There was Antiochus the Fourth. He is the one who is known as Antiochus Epiphanes. And he came down and he made attacks on Egypt, which were unsuccessful. And he was so angry. In fact, some of the Jews had sided with Egypt to try to overthrow him as their ruler. He was so angry at the Jews, he came back and he slaughtered thousands of Jews just in his anger, in his wrath, in his humiliation. He slaughtered a bunch of them. And there was a lot of there were a lot of Jews who opposed him. See, he wanted to impose Greek culture on Palestine, and there were two sects of Jews in Palestine: the precursors of the Sadducees. They weren't called Sadducees at this time, but those who were their precursors wanted to bring in Hellenistic or Greek culture into Israel, and they supported the Greek rule. Then there were those that were like the precursors of the Pharisees. They weren't yet called Pharisees, but they were called the Hasidim, and they wanted to keep the Jewish culture pure. And they didn't want the Greek stuff coming in. And there was this hostility there. Well, Antiochus Epiphanes especially persecuted the Hasidim, the conservative Jews who wanted to keep the culture unmixed. And he outlawed Judaism, essentially. He, on pain of death, he made it a capital offense to own a copy of the scriptures. He made it a capital offense to circumcise your child. He made it a capital offense to keep Sabbath or to do any number of other Jewish things. Now, consider this bind it put the Hasidim in. They were bound to keep the law. They had to circumcise their children. They had to keep Sabbath. And yet doing so would bring death upon them. And it did. And it is recorded that many of these were slaughtered on the Sabbath when they would not lift a sword to defend themselves. They would on another day of the week, but not that day. And they were just slaughtered in cold blood, the Hasidim. These, I believe, are the many that were cast to the ground, many of the stars that were cast to the ground by Antiochus. They were slaughtered and killed. Anyway, it is in this environment that the Maccabean revolt took place. There is no reference, at least no clear reference, in this chapter to the Maccabean revolt, a very significant event in Jewish history. But it is talked about in detail in chapter 11. These visions, these successive visions, go further and further into more detail on these points. But the Maccabean revolt was when some Jewish people rose up against Antiochus. I'll give you details on that when we're in chapter 11. And managed to overthrow him. But see, one of the great offenses Antiochus did to show his contempt for the Jewish religion was he put an altar to Zeus in the Holy of Holies of the Jewish temple. And he sacrificed a pig to the Jew, an unclean animal, on this altar to Zeus in the Holy of Holies. Well, the devout Jews would have nothing to do with the temple after that. It was desecrated. It was defiled. And it was shortly after that that the Maccabean revolt occurred. Well, It took a couple or 3 years for the revolt to drive out the Syrians successfully so they could rededicate the temple. And they did. It was almost exactly 3 years from the time the temple was desecrated to the time that they reinstituted sacrifices there. The commemoration of this rededication of the temple is what the Jews celebrate every year in December, called Hanukkah, which is the Feast of Dedication in John chapter 10. The Jews celebrate this because the Maccabean victories allowed the Jews to reestablish their sacrificial system. They wrested control of Jerusalem from the Syrians, drove them out, and managed to get their own freedom there so they could reinstitute the worship. They cleansed the temple and reinstituted it. It was approximately 3 years, almost exactly 3 years, that the temple was in this state of being desecrated, and the sacrifices were not there. Now, the figure that is given here, during which the temple will be desecrated and the sacrifices cease, is 1,150 days. Now, that's not exactly 3 years. 3 years would be 1,095 days, but that's only 55 days different than 3 years. So, there may be some detail about the period that we've got, the days, or we may be a little off, but it would appear that the length of time that is given here is the length of time that the temple was not in use and sacrificial system was discontinued because of the abomination and because of the desecration of the temple by Antiochus. The period corresponds so closely, the length of time is so close, that it's almost certainly the same period of time, and it may be that in some sense this is a rounded off number, or it may be that if we knew all the details of the history, we'd find it was exactly the right number. And history only remembers it as approximately 3 years. But this still is only 3 years, 1 month, and a few days. A month and a half more than 3 years. So it could be exact, and we just may not have enough accuracy of history, historic knowledge to say.
The temple's
Pardon?
How long was the temple's desecration according to
this? Right around 3 years. I believe the desecration took place in December. And Hanukkah, the rededication, took place in December. I think it was almost exactly 3 years, maybe not to the day, but very close to 3 years of desecration. Now, if we figured the days of that at 365-day years... What's that? I know. And so, that's a bit artificial to use 365 days. If it was 360, you'd have even smaller number of days than that. But if we figured days the way we do, which may not be a justifiable thing to do, it would bring the number to 1,095 days. A little less than that, if it was, it would be 1,080, yeah. So that puts it a few months more. 1,150 days is a few months more than 3 years. And it's hard to know, maybe the period starts earlier than the actual abomination or something, I don't know. No one knows for sure. These numbers in Daniel are some of the enigmas hard to sort out. But some of them come pretty close to being easy to understand. Okay? So this is about that horrible crisis the Hasidim, the faithful Jews, went through in the days of Antiochus. And while it is not given in extreme detail here, it is later. In chapter 11, there's a more complex vision, which includes actual description of the Maccabean revolt, which drove Antiochus' forces out. Now, verse 15. Now, it happened when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and was seeking the meaning, that suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man, and I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, who called and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So he saw two messengers. One of them calls the other one Gabriel, obviously the angel Gabriel, who also brought the message to Mary and to Joseph of the birth of Jesus, and who also figures into the narrative later on. In chapter 12, he's mentioned again. No, I'm sorry, he isn't, but in chapter 10, he is mentioned again. Michael is mentioned in chapter 12. Okay, so Gabriel's not going to give the explanation. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face, but he said to me, understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end. Now, a couple things here. Son of man is an expression that simply means a human. The expression is used scores of times in the Old Testament, hundreds of times, because it's used 90 times in Ezekiel alone, and it's used frequently in the books of Psalms and Proverbs and some of these other books. It's only used twice in Daniel, once here where it obviously refers to Daniel, and once in the previous chapter where we saw one like the Son of Man coming with a cloud. By the way, although one like the Son of Man in chapter 7, verse 13 is capitalized by our translators, there's no reason that it must be capitalized. It could just be, he said, I saw one like a human. And this would be in contrast to the four kingdoms that were like animals previous. You've got a lion, a bear, a leopard, another kind of ferocious beast, and then you've got one like a... Yeah, and they were like a leopard, like a lion, like a bear, you know, like a lion, like a bear, like a leopard, and now one like a man, like a Son of Man. Anyway, the point is that Daniel is reminded that he's human. Sometimes when you have glorious visions, you have to be reminded of that. Paul needed a thorn in his flesh because of the excellency of the visions he had to keep him from being exalted above measure. If you start seeing divine things, you might start thinking you're divine. So Gabriel says, wait a minute, no, you're just a man. Listen, human, these things have to do with the time of the end. Now, the time of the end should not be thought to be the end of the world. Because, first of all, it isn't about that. That wasn't the end of the world. We read later on in verse 23 that in the latter time of their kingdom, meaning the Greek kingdom. So it's not the end of the world. It's not even the end of the Jewish state. It's just the end of the Grecian power, near the time of the end of the Grecian power before the Romans came and took them over. Now, as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me and stood me upright. Now, I hardly think he got bored, like some of us fall asleep in church, but... It must have been some kind of an influence that came over him that caused him to faint or something, but he was made to stand upright by a touch from Gabriel's hand. And he said, look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation, for at the appointed time the end shall be. And then the verses we read earlier, the ram which you saw having two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia. The male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn is between his eyes is the first king, Alexander. As for the broken horn, and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with his power. We've already understood this. Now he explains the little horn. Verse 23. And in the latter time of their kingdom, that is in the latter time of the Greek rulers, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise. This is Antiochus, the little horn. Having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own might. He shall destroy, apparently demonically inspired, he shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. Well, that's pretty much a good description of what he did. Through his cunning, he shall cause deceit to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart. Now, there are details of Antiochus' career that can be shown to correspond with these features. We'll see more of this in chapter 11, and we don't have enough time to go into them now. We'll talk about them then. And he shall magnify himself in his heart. He shall destroy many of their in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes, probably a reference to the king of kings, God. But he shall be broken without human hand. His power was broken by a series of things, but it was by God's hand, essentially, is what it implied here. God is the one who's going to bring him down. And the vision of the evenings and mornings, which was told, is true. Therefore, seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. Now, since this was fulfilled 350 years after his time, it had to be sealed up. Interesting that the book of Revelation, John was told, don't seal it up because it's soon to come. But Daniel, talking about things that were only about 250 years off from his time, that's not near. So seal it up. Suggests that the book of Revelation should be fulfilled sooner than that period of time after John's point in time. But he, therefore seal up the vision, it refers to many days in the future. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for many days. Afterwards I rose and went about the king's business, his regular course of business. I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it. So we got to quit there. It takes its toll seeing this kind of stuff on a guy physically. I've never had a vision like this, but Daniel's reactions and those of Ezekiel and others make it very clear that these visions aren't just psychological exercises, they have very strong physiological impact. But we'll see more on this same time period that this vision represents in chapter 11 when we get there. However, at this point, we'll quit. Are there any questions? Yes, Sam.
Back in chapter 7.
Uh-huh.